So we're going to move into our first conference presenter, Bill Federer. I sort of got to know Bill a little bit through speaking at different conferences with him around the country, and I felt that he was saying things about the culture and about history that I had never heard before. And I had wished my professors when I was in college had talked the way Bill talks. So I said, Bill, we got to get you to come out for our prophecy conference and speak. And he said, I'll do that. Just give me a non-controversial subject. So we assigned him the topic, how to brainwash a nation, the history of psychological warfare. So let's welcome Bill Federer.
Thank you, Dr. Andy Wood, and it's an honor to be here with Dr. Randall Price and Olivier Melnick and each and every one of you.
And I wanted the praise and worship to keep going, didn't you? I mean, that was tremendous. Thank you. Well, I'm going to jump into my presentation. My website's AmericanMinute.com, and got numerous books. The one is Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present, and one of the chapters in there is How to Brainwash a Nation. Now, Scripture. 2 Thessalonians. Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, by our gathering together unto him, that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. I'm skipping past some stuff. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie. So what we see in there is there's a delusion, there's a lying, and lots of people are going to be deceived. How is that going to happen? So we're a spirit, mind, and body. Your mind is like a super fancy computer. It's more than that, but it's at least that.
You guys
got
to start the clock.
Oh. you can leave it off. I'll use it. So you're a spirit, mind, and body. Your mind is like a super fancy computer. It's more than that, but it's at least that. And your body's like the computer case, which makes it silly for people to argue over what color the computer case is. Imagine if I were to say blue computer is better than green computer. It's like, really doesn't matter what color the computer is. What matters is what software is on it, right? Doesn't matter what color the iPhone is what apps are on it. Doesn't matter what color somebody's skin is what behavioral software is running on their brain, right? Yeah. Is it love your enemies or is it cancel them? Anyway, so the battle is over the brain. Spirit loves God. It's drawn toward God. Your body hates God, and your mind is the decider. And so the battle's for the mind, and it's actually a military strategy. Karl von Clausewitz, 19th century military theorist, gave the purpose of war. It's the classic definition. The purpose of war is to force your opponent to submit to your will. Pretty simple. You go through all the battle strategy and guns and cannons, and it's all to do what? To get your opponent to submit to your will. Sun Tzu's Art of War, 5th century BC, said supreme excellence of a commander consists of breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. So you want to get them to submit to your will, but if you're really good, you'll get them to submit without a fight. You'll make them think you're more powerful than you are. You'll demoralize them. They'll get confused. And now it's called fifth generation warfare, where you get your enemy to submit without them even being aware they're in a war, right? Why wake them up? If the goal is to get them to submit, and so the battle is for the mind. And so during the World War II, we called it psychological operations or PSYOPs, cognitive warfare. And we would drop pamphlets down on towns in Eastern Europe and Germany, and they would be written in the language of the people. I met somebody whose dad was in the war and actually kept one of them. But it said, your side is already lost. Your commander just hasn't told you yet. And so these guys are in the field like, you know, it's like, why are we risking our lives? I read we already lost. And it would mess with their mind. And then the Japanese did it to us. Tokyo Rose, Pacific. She had a seductive voice on the radio, and the radio waves would go across the ocean to the ships, and she would say, "You Americans are terrible. You're doing all these terrible stuff. You're terrible." And it would demoralize our guys. And it's in the Bible. So 12 spies go into the promised land, 10 come back with a negative report, and they spread fear and panic. "We're not able to go up. They are too strong for us. The land devours the inhabitants. The people are of great stature. We're grasshoppers in their sight. If only we had died in the land of Egypt." God was so mad at those 10 spies that he struck them dead on the spot, told the rest that they're going to wander 40 years till every one of them is dead, and then he'll take the children into the promised land. They lost the battle in their mind. They didn't even get a chance to fight the enemy. Right? They were demoralized in their brain. They suffered from psychological warfare, and they lost. And we saw this again with Hezekiah and Jerusalem surrounded by the Assyrians. And the Assyrian commander is saying stuff in the Hebrew language, and the ambassador say, "No, speak in the Assyrian language. We understand." They goes, "No, I want the people on the walls to hear. Don't believe Hezekiah. Don't." And he was messing with their mind. "We'll give you 2,000 horses if you got guys to ride." I mean, he was trying to demoralize them. And then, in a good way, the Israelites did psychological warfare. Here's an army of 100,000 Midianites. And rather than fight them, God tells Gideon, "Get 300 guys, stand in a circle around the camp with your torches, with a clay pot and the trumpet. Signal's given, you smash it, you blow the trumpet." And they're just standing there blowing the trumpet. And these, the enemy gets up, and in the dark, they're bumping into each other and pull out their swords, and they're hacking each other, they're killing each other in the dark. They succumbed to psychological warfare. And so we see this is all over. Now, the goal of psychological warfare, is to get your enemy into fear and get them to be demoralized and surrender. And so God tells Gideon, "Whoever is fearful and afraid, let them return and depart." And oh, thank you, Olivia. And so, what does the Bible say? It says, fear not, over and over again. "Fear thou not, fear him not, fear them not. Thou shalt not fear, neither shall thou fear, fear no evil." And so we know that the enemy wants to get us into fear. Fear is the opposite of faith. You cannot be in fear and faith at the same time, right? It's like a switch. It can either be on or off. And if you're in fear, Job says, "The things I greatly feared came upon me." If you're in fear, you're not in faith, and the evil's going to come. But God says, "No, stand in faith. Stand in faith. Fear not." If you can't beat them, join them. So I have a tech study. I wrote a whole book on Islam. I'm talking about some of it on Sunday. But the Muslim Brotherhood used this. Now, World War I, Ottoman Empire's gone. The Middle East wants to westernize. And so we begin to see countries like Iran in the 1960s and 70s. Then they're dressing in Western clothes and looks like Southern California, like Berkeley. And here's Afghanistan, Kabul, women wearing skirts, going to class. And this is the 1960s and 70s. Syria having beauty pageants, Gamal Nasser of Egypt. And here's the women wearing the latest fashions. And, it looks like the Beach Boys in Egypt in the 1960s and 70s. He's wearing Western clothes. And what happened? How did we go from a westernizing Middle East to what we have today? Well, this is one little short video of what I just explained, but they had these freedoms. We don't necessarily need the music. We can turn the music down. No, seriously, I shared a video one time, and the YouTube caught the music and said, "Oh, this is copyrighted music." And so then they canceled it. They wouldn't let the whole video up. But you see this change there. And it wasn't that long ago. So the Muslim Brotherhood is responsible for this. The French built the Suez Canal. British took it over in the 1880s. And so it's a British-run Suez Canal. And then they have six employees of the British-run Suez Canal, and they formed the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. And so their idea, is to infiltrate countries and overthrow the countries that are becoming pro-West. And the Muslim Brotherhood spawned off all these terrorist groups that we're facing today. And so they based their strategy on the two cities Muhammad lived in. In Mecca, Muhammad was a religious leader. In Medina, Muhammad becomes a political and military leader. And he kills 3,000 people and fights in 66 battles. So the Muslim Brotherhood said, let's make this our strategy. We'll go into countries as religious Muslims, and when the signal's given, we'll turn into political and militant Muslims and overthrow the country. And so they did this in the Middle East and Egypt and all those countries. And King Abdullah of Jordan, he was actually nice to the Jews, and the Muslim Brotherhood infiltrated people assassinate him. Anwar Sadat, he does a treaty with Israel. Menachem and Begin, they both get the Nobel Peace Prize. Billy Graham praises Anwar Sadat for this peace. Well, guess what? The Muslim Brotherhood had infiltrated the Egyptian military. It was an affiliated group. And they're having a parade. And the people that infiltrated the military stop in the parade and level their machine guns, and they kill Anwar Sadat. They assassinate the leader of the country. And so it's the strategy where you go into a country as an immigrant, and then you move into the minority neighborhoods and begin to become politically involved. And then you get violent and drive out the previous inhabitants of the country. But it's an infiltrating. Now, we're familiar with marketing and the psychological warfare, the brainwashing of a nation. It has infiltration, but it also has marketing. And if you think of it, what is marketing? It's wanting to convince people in their brain to buy a product. And so in the 1900s, marketing was Wells Fargo Wagon and Sears Catalog, and they would tell you everything about a Singer sewing machine, and you would make an informed purchase. But then the early 1900s, you had a change in advertising where they would say nothing about a product, but you'd eat it anyway. It's like the classic was Crisco. Nobody knew what Crisco was made out of. But they marketed it so well, it put out of business the lard industry. And so it's cottonseed oil. In the Deep South, they'd harvest cotton, and they would have these leftover black seeds that they would mush into industrial seed oil and use it in factories and machinery. Nobody ate that stuff, but somebody had the idea of bleaching it, putting in these nice containers with an ad campaign. They even invented a term, vegetable-based. It's like, what is that? And so this understanding was people will buy something that they know nothing about if it looks like everybody's using it. And so this concept, they did a cartoon in the New York newspaper, Keeping Up with the Joneses. You're buying all these products just because your neighbor has it. You don't know anything about it. You just want it. And the person that introduced this was Edward Bernays. He is the nephew of Sigmund Freud, the psychoanalyst that discovered what? That discovered we're social creatures, right? And we want to fit in, and we don't want to be rejected. Simple, but powerful. And so he writes a book called Propaganda in 1928, and he says, women think they're buying shoes. They're not. The shoes are picked out for them by the marketing executive who paid the actors to put them on, who paid the photographer to take the pictures, who paid the magazines to put those pictures in there, and the ladies see it and want it. And he says, women are controlled by this. And so he writes in his book, he says, a larger manufacturer of women's shoes has a popular actress, wear the shoes, the fashion spreads. The man who injected this idea into the shoe industry was ruling women in one department of their social lives. Today, the minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing the majority to mold the minds of the masses. They find in propaganda a tool which is increasingly powerful, regimenting the public mind. So Edward Bernays started marketing cigarettes, and it was a women's parade for suffrage, you know, to vote, and he had a couple women stand there there with cigarettes, and he took the pictures, and so he got all these women to smoke cigarettes. I mean, he was like brilliant in marketing because he realized that we want to fit in. And so he changed the name of propaganda to public relations. And he said, in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct, ethical thinking, we're dominated by a relatively small number of persons. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind. Now, we're a country in the Declaration, government from the consent of the governed. But what if you could engineer consent of the governed? So he writes a book called The Engineering of Consent. Manipulation of the opinion of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. And so you vote, but you vote based on what you read about the candidates. Well, who controls what you read? So if they can control that information. And he writes another book, Crystallizing Public Opinion. And then another book that Noam Chomsky writes, Manufacturing Consent. And so our country is controlled by laws. Laws are controlled by politicians. Politicians are controlled by voters. Voters are controlled by public opinion. And public opinion is controlled by media in the short run, education in the long run, and through the church. Now, in colonial America, there was just the church. Right? It's been diminishing in its influence, but that's why they want to get it woke, because they know it still can influence people. And then the internet, because all of them use the internet nowadays to communicate. So whoever controls the internet and can infiltrate churches and make them woke, and infiltrate schools, and then infiltrate the media, they control what the people hear and know. And then based on what they hear and know, they form opinions, and then they vote based on their opinions, and then the candidates get in because they were voted in, and then the candidates make the laws, and then the laws control the country. So the battle's for the mind. Judge Learned Hand said, the hand that rules the press, the radio, the screen, and the far-spread magazine rules the country. Llewellyn Rockwell wrote, democracy has turned out to be not majority rule, but ruled by a well-organized and well-connected minority groups who steal from the majority. Will and Ariel Durant wrote, democracy is the most difficult of all forms of government, since it requires the widest spread of intelligence. Ignorance lends itself to manipulation by the forces that mold public opinion. We saw this during the Spanish-American War. In Cuba, Spain was starving the people. About a quarter of the country was in concentration camps because they wanted independence and Spain didn't want them to have it. And they're 90 miles off the coast, but America doesn't want to get involved because we're still recovering from the Civil War. And so William Randolph Hearst has his New York Journal. Joseph Pulitzer has his New York World, and that's where Pulitzer Prize came from. And they printed newspapers on inexpensive paper that turned yellow after a couple days. And so they called it yellow press journalism. And so they realized that, gee, with owning newspapers, we can sway the opinion of the country. So where the country didn't want to get involved in the plight of the Cubans, they wanted to sway the country. So these Cubans are being starved to death by this Colonel Weiler, who's a cruel guy, and Hearst. They did not have the ability to print photographs in the newspapers yet. So you needed an illustrator to draw a picture that they could turn into like an engraving and then print it. So Hearst sends Frederick Remington, an artist, to Cuba, 1897, and he tells him, you furnish the pictures and I'll furnish the war. He had such confidence in his ability to take those pictures and keep putting them in front of the public, and then the public would be swayed, and the public would pressure the politicians, and then the politicians would get into the war. And so we have Oswald Spengler wrote, democracy has become a weapon of the moneyed interests. Now, I think it was good that we freed Cuba from Spain, and Cuba needs to be freed again. But it goes on to say, it uses the media to create the illusion that there is consent of the governed. So you will do what you see other people doing, and if they can create this illusion that it looks like everybody's doing something, you're going to feel a subconscious pressure to want to go along with the group. And he goes on, the press today is an army of carefully organized weapons, the journalists, its officers, the readers, its soldiers. The reader neither knows nor is supposed to know the role he's supposed to play. Democracy is often a government of wealthy elites. And then we have fear. So we have people doing what they see other people doing, but then another motivator is fear. So 1938, radio drama, War of the Worlds, Orson Welles. We interrupt this program to announce that New Jersey is being invaded by Martians. And they did this radio drama so convincingly that people believed it. And everybody in the country ran outside to look up for spaceships. And it was a phenomenon that was studied by psychologists, that you could, boom, get an entire nation. So now we realize you can motivate people through doing what they see others doing and fear. And so they had a whole series of psychological dramas that was all based on manipulating your perception. And one was the movie Gaslighting. And so Ingrid Bergman starred in it. And in it, she's the niece of a famous actress in London who had been given some jewels. The actress dies, and the niece, Ingrid Bergman, inherits the jewels and her flat, her, you know, like apartment they have in London where they have all of them. And then, and so everybody knows that there's jewels in there somewhere. And a guy befriends Ingrid Bergman and dates her and courts her and marries her. And then he would say, well, you go to sleep. I'm going to go smoke my pipe. And he would go out the house, walk around the block, climb up the fire escape, go on the roof, climb across the roof, open up the window, climb in the window, turn the gas lamp on in the attic to root around looking for jewels, because she had locked the attic because it was too emotional to go up there and look at it all. But whenever he turned the gas lamp on in the attic, the gas lamp in the bedroom got dimmer. And she would say, you know, whenever you go for your walk, the gas light in my bedroom gets dimmer. And he goes, your eyes are playing tricks on you. You're seeing things. I think the stress is getting to you. I think you're too emotional. I think we need to take you to a psychologist. And the psychiatrist, and they're about to lock her away in an insane asylum. And then he can root around for jewels all he wants. But a guy across the street notices whenever the light goes on in the attic, it's dimmer in her bedroom because there's only a certain amount of gas that comes into that flat. And then they arrest the guy and take him away. But it went into our vernacular, gaslighting. So Psychology Today says victims of gaslighting are systematically fed false information that leads them to question what they know to be true. They end up doubting their memory, their perception, even their sanity. And so it's usually like, got, you know, terrible people that want to, you know, get a girl, you know, and tries to mess with her mind. But it's done on a nationwide basis. So during World War II, this ability to manipulate perception, you have Army and Air Force Motion Picture Service. I'm serving in the Army. What are you doing? Was it for entertainment? No, they knew that they wanted to move the country to be mobilized for a war. I met a guy years ago that he had 1940s, went to the movie theater and saw the movie of the young guy volunteering and becoming a real good soldier and winning and then coming back and being the hero. And he went out and all these guys are signing up at the recruitment table in the lobby of the movie theater. Now, it was for a patriotic purpose because there really was a Nazi threat. But they realized that you can sway people through media. Well, guess what? The Nazis studied Edward Bernays. And the Nazi minister of propaganda, what a title, was Joseph Goebbels. And he said, okay, people will do what they see other people doing, and people will be motivated by fear, so let's combine them. And let's put all the people together, 100,000 of them, in a coliseum in Berlin, and they would begin with the atmosphere of war. They would begin to give the Hitler salute in the front, and it would work its way back like a wave at a football game. And it would be getting closer to you and closer to you, and then you'd feel pressure to give it, and somebody would see you giving it, and they'd feel pressure to give it. And everybody would leave the stadium saying, well, I guess everybody's in on it because I all saw them, you know, saluting. It was a manipulation of public perception. Goebbels says it is the absolute right of the state to supervise the formation of public opinion. Think of the press as a great keyboard which the government can play. Now, cities, Polis means city. Politics is the business of the city. And you had these Greek cities with no king. And so if you have an agenda in the city of Athens, how do you push your agenda? There's no king. And that's when they invented theater. And they would get the whole city together and put on plays, comedies, tragedies, satires. And you think, oh, was that for entertainment? No, it was a way to sway the populace. There's no king. It's the people that are in charge. And if I have an agenda and I want to push it, I want to get it. And so in these plays, they would ridicule and buffoon certain points of view and honor and extol other points of view. And so they're comedies like Aristophanes. They would make fun of living politicians exactly the same way Saturday Night Live does. And you would leave the stadium, the auditorium, saying, oh, I felt so sorry for them. I'm embarrassed for that person. And you would back away from them and everything they believed. And then in the tragedies, they would make somebody die doing something noble, and he would be remembered in such a positive way. And you'd leave this auditorium thinking, oh, I want to be remembered like that guy. And so they could posit it. And from that time till now, Pericles even paid for poor people to go to the theater. Why would he do that? Is he that nice? No, he knew he wanted to sway the populace. And so from that time till now, theater is always political in a country where it's the people who make the decisions. So Hollywood, think of your favorite movie or sitcom. There's a character you like. They're cute. They're funny. They're the hero. And as the series goes on, this character begins to make morally compromising decisions. A little lying, little cheat, little lust, little revenge. Like the first couple of episodes, they'll have the guy be really good, and then you'll be able to connect with him. But then they begin to gradually make them do things that are a little questionable. And then you find yourself apologizing for that character, saying, yeah, I know James Bond is with a woman that he's not married to, but he's about to save the world. So can we get on with the story? Right? And it minimizes something that used to be important to you, marital fidelity. And then they make the hero look so good that you want to wear their tennis shoes and their perfume, right? And so they're manipulating you because you've invested in this character. But it's theater. It's Hollywood. And somebody's paying for it. They're not. So we look at Athens, and Athens had a combination of both theater, but then something called fifth column. So in warfare, you have two columns and then two flanks to attack from the sides. What's the fifth column? That's people inside your enemy's camp or enemy city that demoralizes them, that confuses them, that weakens them from the inside. So instead of a direct confrontation, so you have a quote from Cicero, a nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. An enemy at the gates is less formidable, for he is known and he carries his banners openly against the city. But the traitor moves among those within the gates freely, his sly whispers heard in the very halls of government. He works secretly to undermine the pillars of a city. He infects the body politic so that it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to be feared. And so during World War II, we had the fear of the Nazis coming in and infiltrating But the infiltration, you had Stalin wanted to conquer the West with tanks. And Antonio Gramsci said, you'll never defeat the West on the battlefield. You have to rot it from within. And so he calls it, it's called the long march through the institutions. You're going to have to take a few generations and infiltrate the West and infiltrate all of their media and education. He said in 1916, socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity. And then James Wardner wrote, in the new order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media, transforming the consciousness of society. So it's been, there's different categories of society, but one is called the Seven Mountains: arts, business, education, family, government, media, religion. These all used to belong to the church. Because at the time of America's founding, 98% of the country was Protestant, 3 million people, 1% Catholic, 30,000 Catholics, 0.1% Jewish, only 3,000 Jews in a country of 3 million, only 7 synagogues in the whole country. But it was all Judeo-Christian. So we controlled everything. but we sat back. And so during the Cold War, you had the communists infiltrating, like Antonio Gramsci suggested. And in 1963, Albert Hurlong, congressman, read their 45 goals, and I just listed some here. Infiltrate the press, infiltrate the churches, and replace revealed religion with social religion. Infiltrate and gain control of more unions, infiltrate, gain control of big business like BlackRock, State Street, Vanguard, all those, and capture one or both political parties, gain control of key positions in radio and TV. This is 1963 that they talk about it. You know, one of the key examples of media swaying people was the first televised presidential debate, Nixon, Kennedy. Nixon did not put on makeup. And the bright studio lights made him look like he had bags under his eyes and he looked pretty bad. Kennedy put on makeup. Everybody that heard the debate on the radio said Nixon won. Everybody that saw it on TV, primarily women, said Kennedy won because he looked younger and nicer. And so this, it doesn't really matter what they say. It's this perception of the impression. And so Albert Hurlong goes on, get control of teachers' association, put party line in textbooks, get control of the schools, use them as transmission belts for socialism, communist propaganda, use student riots to foment protests. This was in the 1960s. Get control of the schools. They've been working this. Now, an individual water molecule acts a certain way, but you put it with other water molecules and that it acts together like a wave. An individual fish in a bowl, but you put it with other fish and they operate together. You put a bird in a cage, but you put it with other birds, it operates as a group. And guess what? We're individuals, but you put us with other individuals and we operate as a group. We're always giving and receiving feedback of, are we being accepted or are we being rejected? You're constantly saying stuff, I'm going to be rejected. Are they receiving or are they rejected? And so this is different. So most of the world is what's called honor shame culture, that you will do what you have the group honors you for, and you will not do what the group shames you and ostracizes you and ridicules you for. And this is different than the Bible. The Bible says you're not supposed to care about the group. And they manipulate the desire to fit in, and it's been going into the classrooms. And so it's called social emotional learning or behavior modification. And it is taking all of what I just explained to you and applying it to little innocent kids. And Alinsky said, ridicule is man's most potent weapon. Nobody wants to be left out of the party and not put on the team. And you know, everybody wants to be picked. And so you think of Disney. Here is billions of dollars worth of product. You know, frozen t-shirts, frozen pajamas, frozen band-aids, frozen lunchboxes. A lot of products, a lot of money's being changed hands, and it's all based on what? Convincing a child to want something. Billions of dollars, and it's all based on what can we do to get a little child to want something. And children will do what they see other people doing. They see all their friends at school wearing this kind of tennis shoes, and they say, I want this kind of cereal at the grocery store. And so now they've weaponized it. It's called the pyramid of oppression. And they teach this in the classroom. The top of the pyramid are the cisgendered. That's their term for somebody who believes there's a male and a female. They're the oppressors. They're on the top of the pyramid. They're the oppressors. Everybody else down the pyramid, asexual, bisexual, homosexual, pansexual, transsexual, they're being oppressed by the oppressors. And then they ask the kids, which one are you? Well, none of the kids are going to pick the oppressor, so they'll pick anything else. And you look at it, here's Maryland Public's largest school district sees a 500% increase in non-binary trans students. Trans-identifying students increased 991% in 2 years in wealthy D.C. suburb. Here's one, 1,800 students at UC Davis identify as trans, non-binary. Here's one, unprecedented 5,000% surge in trans teens. I just read that the Generation Z, I guess what they call the younger ones, a quarter of them are now identifying as LGBTQ. In just 4 years of this being taught in schools, it works. Kids want to fit in. They don't want to be rejected. They've weaponized it. And if somebody comes out as a trans, they like celebrate it. And then so if somebody's against that, they're like implicitly saying, you're the intolerant one. Another thing they do in school is deconstruction. It's where you portray the past negatively until the kids emotionally detach from them. Then you get them into a neutral where they don't remember where they came from, and then you portray the future positively. It's a sales technique. If I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I do is tell you negative things about the toothpaste you're currently brushing with. You're still brushing with that stuff? Haven't you read it'll eat the enamel off your teeth? You're like, you're repulsed by it. Now I have you in a neutral, you're open-minded. What are all the toothpastes out there? Then I give you my pitch for this brand new tartar-controlled breath freshener toothpaste. So it's sort of a drive neutral reverse. So they go into the classrooms and they tell the kids the founders were all slave owners and chauvinists and took land from Indians and they were bad, bad, bad. Forget the fact they gave you a country where you're in charge, because the word citizen means co-king, right? Forget all that. They're all bad. And the kids are like, ooh, they're bad, and I'm going to detach from them and everything they did. And then now the kids are in a neutral. And they're saying, okay, we're going to have comparative religion class, and we're going to talk about Islam, and we're going to talk about, and we just don't have time to get around to Christianity. And then they portray the future positively and push their socialism, their LGBT, trans, and Islamism, and so forth. And so Europe went through this. It went through 1,000 years of Catholic cathedrals, Protestant Reformation, and Jewish neighborhoods. And then it went into a secular Europe with free sex, anything goes, John Lennon, imagine there's no heaven. And now it's turning into Sharia socialist Europe with Muhammad being the number one name for newborns. And so this a destroying of the past started with the French Revolution. They tore down statues of good King Henry IV, who tried to patch up Protestants and Catholics. They dug up the grave of St. Genevieve and trashed it. She lived in the 450s, and she got Paris to fast and pray, so Attila skipped sacking Paris. I mean, during this French Revolution, they wanted to destroy history because they wanted to do something new, right? And China did this. So 3rd century BC, the Warring States period, half a dozen kingdoms fighting. One guy wins, Qin Shi Huangdi, and he unifies China, and he gets criticized for doing things differently than they had been done for centuries before. And he got tired of being criticized. So he decided to destroy all records of how things were done before. And he burnt tens of thousands of bamboo annal books. He wanted to get rid of history. His chancellor, Li Si, 213 BC, writes, "I, your servant, propose that all historians' records other than those of Qin's be burned. If anyone under heaven has copies of the classics of history, they shall deliver them to the governor for burning. Anyone who dares discuss the classics of history will be publicly executed. Anyone who uses history to criticize the present shall have his family executed. And anyone who has failed to burn the books after 30 days of this announcement shall be sent to build the Great Wall." It's sort of like a censorship. Like in Germany, they're doing censorship. In England and China. And so Mao Zedong, when he took over, he did the same thing that Qin Shi Huangdi did. And it's called the Cultural Revolution, not just a revolution, cultural. He destroyed 5,000 years of Chinese culture. And he burned the great gates of Beijing, destroyed the oldest Buddhist temple in China. So this idea is that you ridicule people that have any Western learning and publicly shame them. Then Pol Pot did the same thing in Cambodia. He went so far as to say that 1975 was the new year zero. Anything happened prior to that was irrelevant. And he killed anybody that wore glasses. He said, if you wore glasses, you could read. If you read, you knew the history. And he wanted to destroy history because he killed a third of his country. And then Islam does it. So when the Muslims were invading Egypt, the oldest library in the world was there in Cairo, Alexandria. And when they went to Caliph Umar, they said, what should we do with these books? And he says, well, every book that does not agree with the Quran, destroy. And every book that does agree with the Quran is redundant because we have the Quran, so destroy them all. It took 6 months to burn them all. And anyway, they're destroying history even today. Carl Sandburg said, when a nation goes down, one condition may always be found. They forgot where they came from. Am I talking too fast?
No.
I got that clock. More recently, George Orwell wrote 1984, written in 1948. I just switched the numbers. And there's an actor named Winston, a character. He's sitting at his desk. He works for the government's Ministry of Truth, which basically does all the lying. And he sits at his desk, and down the little pneumatic tube that was a new invention, like at a bank you put in your deposit, comes the history that needs to be edited. and he would do the editing, and he would take the original history and put it in another pneumatic tube. It would be sucked down into the incinerator in the basement and burned. It's called down the memory hole. And so he writes about this. Every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present, which the parties always write. I know, of course, that the past is falsified, but it would never be possible for me to prove it, even when I did the falsification myself. After the thing is done, no evidence remains. The only evidence is inside my own mind, and I don't know that any other human being shares my memories. Everything faded into mist. The past was erased. The erasure was forgotten. The lie became truth. If there's no God, why tell the truth? Your agenda becomes, right? Saul Alinsky, your agenda is the truth. And so you want to do anything you can to achieve, because if there's no God, there's no right and wrong, and you just want to do whatever you want. And so so here we have the government spending money to study disinformation, and there's more there. I'm going to skip past some stuff. So now it's called the 1619 Project, Howard Zinn, and people's history, and it's all to portray the past negatively so the students will detach from it so that they can pull them into whatever socialist future they have. You have the color revolution. So after World War II, countries in Europe were free, and they formed republics and elected leaders, and they were trying to dig themselves out of the World War II, but the Soviets didn't like that. So they send in agents to do what's called critical theory. You spend a little time and just live amongst them and observe all the groups, economic groups, ethnic groups, Bosnians, Croats, Serbs, religious groups, Sunni, Shia, Orthodox, and you classify them, some as victims, some as oppressors, the haves and have-nots. And then you would organize protests that you would escalate into riots and violence and bloodshed. Why bloodshed? Because then people think emotionally and not logically. And then you co-opt the media and channel all that emotion to blame the leader of the country for all the problems. And as people read it and blame the leader's popularity falls. And then they can do a coup or a rigged election and replace the leader with a Soviet puppet. And then the rioting suddenly stops, and everybody's happy until the dust settles and they realize they just became a satellite of the Soviet Union and they lost their freedoms. And so with this co-opting of the media, we had our CIA doing what was called the Mockingbird Project. And Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA. And he had 400 people in the mainstream media that the CIA would feed stories to and to sway the public to adopt whatever agenda. So Carl Bernstein, Watergate reporter, Rolling Stone magazine, 1977, front page article, the CIA and the media. And he talked about these influencers. They disbanded it supposedly, but Obama brought it back with an executive order. We're hearing executive orders, but this was his. Using behavioral science insights to better serve the American people. What's behavioral science insights? It's PSYOPs. This authorized him to bring back the Mockingbird Project, to have the government realize that we're social creatures and we'll do what we see other people doing, and so the government can control the media and cancel the voices that they don't want. Why? Because they want to sway the public into adopting their agenda. And then he signed the Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation Act, which allowed him to decide what information is disinformation and what's not. Under cover of Christmas, Obama establishes controversial anti-propaganda agency. It says, before the 2016 Christmas holiday, President Obama has quietly signed the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act. Deep within the act is a controversial position called Countering Foreign Propaganda and Disinformation, which establishes a global engagement center under the State Department and consolidates the power of several federal broadcasting entities. The consolidation of power creates some concern regarding journalistic independence and credibility of media outlets. So, Mike Waller wrote a book, Big Intel, how Cold War heroes became spy villains, how the left subverted the CIA and the FBI. The dramatic story of the Cold War heroics, of the CIA, right? Because they were helping to overthrow countries. So our CIA did the KGB thing in reverse because we didn't want countries to be in the Soviet orbit. So we would have them infiltrate countries and do crisis and then co-opt the media to blame the leader, and then we would get rid of the leader. But it says, the dramatic story of Cold War heroics of the CIA followed by its slide into Marxist influence and deep state dysfunction. Once upon a time, the FBI and CIA fought America's enemies at home and abroad. Now they are tools of the growing police state, attacking the left's political enemies, spying on ordinary American citizens, even parents who push back against radical public schools. How did we get here? And then Google agrees to pay $110 million to do what? To fund local newsrooms. So now they want to take their psyops into your little local newspaper. And TikTok. And I thought this was an interesting scripture. 1 Kings 22. And Ahab, the king of Israel, had Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, come up. And he says, "Wilt thou go with me to battle at Ramoth-Gilead?" And the king of Israel gathered the prophets, about 400 pagan ones, and they all said, "Go up, the Lord will deliver it into your hands." And Jehoshaphat said, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord that we might inquire of him?" And the king of Israel said, "Well, there is this Micaiah, but I hate him, for he doth not prophesy good concerning me." And Jehoshaphat said, "Let not the king say so." Then the king of Israel called Micaiah, and Micaiah said, "I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by him." And the Lord said, "Who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up to Ramoth-Gilead and fall?" And the one said this manner, another that. And then there came forth a spirit and stood before the Lord and said, "I will persuade him." And the Lord said, "Wherewith?" And he said, "I will go forth and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets." And the Lord said, "Thou shalt persuade him, go forth." A lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets, plural. So you have all these prophets, but it's that same lying spirit that's in there. I thought this was an interesting. I don't know if you can turn the volume up on this or not.
Wolf, our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But
we are concerned about troubling, trying to be responsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
This is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Notice the company that is displayed in the background there. So here you have this being used over and over again. Other clips that I share, but I'm not going to have time for them. Rand Paul grills Biden, Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, about his disinformation governance board. And Rand Paul says, "Do you know who the greatest propagator of disinformation in world history is? The U.S. government. I think you've got no idea what disinformation is. Are you familiar with McNamara, Pentagon Papers? Are you familiar with George W. Bush, weapons of mass destruction? Are you familiar with the Iran-Contra? I don't want government guardrails. I want you to have nothing to do with speech. Do you think the American people are so stupid that they need you to tell them what truth is? I don't trust government to figure out what truth is. Government is largely disseminating disinformation. Personally, I think it was a miracle that Elon Musk bought Twitter and broke their narrative." Yeah. And Lord Acton said, "Official truth is not actual truth." And then Kissinger said, it's not a matter of what is true that counts, but a matter of what is perceived to be true. And I thought this was interesting. Americans trust mass media. Democrats, 73%, independents and Republicans, 10%. So you've got more of the Holy Spirit that warns you of when you're hearing a lie. And so lots of articles on this. And so this was interesting. A lot of money that goes to foreign countries, actually the corrupt leader keeps a part of it and lives really good. And the rest of it gets funneled back to the politicians in America that voted to give them the money. It's a money laundering scheme. Anyway, psychological operation and brainwashing. Now, during the Cold War, people made it through World War II. Remember Stalag 13 and The Great Escape and Hogan's Heroes. You know, they're in a little barracks and they're all buddying up and encouraging each other. Not the Korean War. They would isolate our guys for days, weeks, months until they got to this emotional, vulnerable place where they just craved wanting to have another human interaction. Right? They want to be with the buddies, a slap on the back. And when they're at this vulnerable spot, they would bring them into a room of guys who had already caved. But before they could be accepted in the group and get that emotional support that they craved, they had to reject America. Okay, America's bad. All right, you're one of us now. Okay. And after they were rescued, they still hated America. And our people, country psychologists are like, what happened to them? And so they realized that if you isolate people, lock them in their homes, get them to social distance, 6 feet, and until they just crave wanting to get back to normal. And they say, okay, but before you can get back to normal, you have to put this in your body, wear this on your face, and let us track you everywhere you go. And you're like, yeah, whatever. I just want to go back shopping again. I just want to go for a restaurant again. And so it was this manipulation of our desire to want to fit in with others. And they would give, anyway. So then they did what's called the Solomon-Ash conformity experiment. Again, they're trying to figure out how group acceptance manipulates. So they would pull 8 students into a classroom. 7 had been paid ahead of time to be actors. 1 was a naive participant. And the teacher put 2 cards on the front desk. 1 card had 1 line, the other 3 lines. And one by one, they would go around the room, and the paid actors would say that the shorter line was equal to the first line. And they would say it really convincingly and everything. And it finally got around to that 8th naive participant. 30% of them would deny their own eyes to fit in with the group. They're looking at the lines with their own eyes and they're not equal. But they say, well, everybody else says they're equal. I think they're equal too. Now, if just one other person disagreed, it went from 30% down to 5%. And they call it the spiral of silence. People will self-censor their views if they think they are in the minority. Right? If you think that you're in the minority, you'll just keep quiet. And another guy talking about. So Chuck Colson talks about a wine tasting, and everybody was in on the experiment except one naive couple, and they poured vinegar in the wine. This couple writes, this tastes terrible. But then they go around the room and everybody else says, oh, it was robust. It was great. And this couple scratched out what they wrote and they agreed with the group. Oh, yeah, they tasted really good. And then when somebody said all they did was pour vinegar in the wine, the couple that changed their views criticized the person for saying they poured vinegar in. And it's a phenomenon called false enforcement. Once people buy into the lie, they will help enforce that other people buy into the lie. Like, I don't know why I'm wearing this on my face, but I'm going to pull up my camera. You don't have it on yours, right? And so you get the little electrons lined up, and they'll put pressure on the rest of them. And so, Exodus 23, neither shall you follow the multitude in doing evil. So here they are saying there will be a multitude, and they will be doing evil, and you're supposed to be the stick in the mud. The whole human experience is a choice. Now, I'll talk about it other times, but you have all of creation, and God has everything run by rules, and we're the only ones with a free will, and he made us for fellowship. He made us to love him, but there needs to be the choice not to love him, for the choice to love him to be the choice to love him, And so it's called The Forsaking of All Others and Choosing the One. And I'm going to do one other experiment. I got 3 minutes left. So after the Holocaust, they're like, are all the Germans bad? And then they did this one experiment. And
a decade earlier, psychologist Stanley Milgram had also looked at how we respond to authority.
Yale.
In order to understand how people were induced to obey unjust regimes and participate in atrocities such as the Holocaust, he set up an experiment. Volunteers were told they were taking part in scientific research to improve memory.
Would you open those and tell me which of you is which, please?
Separated by a screen, the teacher would ask the learner questions in a word game and administer an electric shock when the answer was incorrect. He was told to increase the voltage with each wrong answer.
Cloud, horse, rock, house. Answer. Wrong. Unwrap 50 volts. Answer, horse.
Experiment, that's all. Get me out of here. Get me out of here, please.
Continue, please. Go right on.
You refuse to go in. Let me out.
You refuse to go in. The experiment requires you continue, teacher. Please continue.
Participants didn't know that the learner was really an actor, and the so-called shocks harmless.
You're going to get a shock, 180 volts.
Ow! I can't stand the pain.
I'm not going to kill that man, is there? I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here. Continue, please.
All right, next one. Slow. Walk, dance, truck, music.
Two-thirds of volunteers were prepared to administer a potentially fatal electric shock when encouraged to do so by what they perceived as a legitimate authority figure. In this case, a man in a white coat.
375 volts. I think something's happened to that fella in there. I don't get no answer. He was hollering a less voltage. Can't you check in and see if he's all right, please?
Milgram's findings horrified America. They showed that decent American citizens were as capable of committing acts against their conscience as the Germans had been under the Nazis.
So people will do what they see somebody in a lab coat telling them to. So we've taken buying shoes because it looks like everybody's doing it to administering a deadly shock. Why? Because you want to have approval from somebody. And so the battle is for our minds. I don't have time for it, but another part called psychological projection where they do bad stuff and they blame you for it. Potiphar's wife accused Joseph of lusting after her when she was lusting after him. And this is a Military Review magazine, 1960. And it says, this is an example of propaganda, technique of name-calling. It is what the psychologists call projection. If you do something wrong, accuse the enemy of doing it before he accuses you. The one who makes it first has the advantage. A person ascribes motives to the opposition. He says, we've all heard children claim he hit me first in order to escape blame for the fight. Soviet Union behaves the same way. So this is where you have them doing bad stuff and blaming you. David Axelrod was an advisor to a previous president. He said in Chicago, there was an old tradition of throwing a brick through your own campaign office window and then calling a press conference to say you've been attacked. So you do the bad stuff and you blame the opposition. And so when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, She approved money flowing, coming from, Ukraine. She approved this Uranium One deal, and then $145 million from these sources appear in her Clinton Foundation. And so she's colluding with Russia. So what does she do? She pays for his deal dossier to accuse Trump of colluding with Russia, right? And here it is. Hillary Clinton campaign pays $113,000 FEC fine in admission of guilt for producing the Steele dossier. And then you have Biden saying, I'm going to withhold money from Ukraine unless they stop investigating my son. So he's extorting Ukraine. What do? They accuse Trump of extorting Ukraine. Biden had classified documents in his garage. What do? They accuse Trump of having classified documents. They just wanted the headlines because they did this projection where they blame you. And Mitt Romney, Harry Reid lied about Mitt Romney not paying his taxes. And then Time Magazine said he did pay his taxes, and Romney says, well, I lied, but he didn't win, did he? So it's okay to do the bad stuff and blame the opponent for doing the bad stuff. And there's more there. Charlie Hurt, Fox News, the whole thing is like this game of projection. Whatever they accuse President Trump of doing, we find out that not only did President Trump not do it, but they did it. Elon Musk, they deflect attention away from themselves. It's sort of like a preemptive moral strike. Those who are saying that Trump is a threat to democracy are themselves actually the threat to democracy. And Nancy Pelosi called it the wrap-up smear. It's a diversionary tactic. You demonize them, and the wrap-up smear, you smear somebody with falsehoods, and then it's reported in the press. And anyway, it's a lot more there. So you have the minority of high priests, the priests stirring up the people to want Jesus. The people love Jesus. Here, 4 days earlier, Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding a donkey, and they're saying, Hosanna in the highest, and so they're praising him. But the small minority of priests manipulated the people to say, crucify him. And so why are we saying this? Because we see that they're trying to, they're going to try to manipulate people in the last days. You know, there's the story of King Zedekiah, and he's bad. And Jeremiah says, if you surrender to the king of Babylon, Jerusalem is going to be spared. And Zedekiah says, what will the Jews in captivity say about me? It's like, dude, you just got told by the prophet that this city is going to be burnt to the ground. And you care about what some people who are already in captivity are going to say about you? The fear of rejection is very powerful. Are you willing to be rejected by your friends? It says some were going to follow Jesus, but they didn't confess him publicly, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they love the praise of men more than the praise of God. And so Peter's with a group around a fire, and a girl gets in his face and says, you were with Jesus. And you can just picture Peter looking around the fire, and everybody's eyeing him, and he realizes he's about to get kicked out of this group. No more acceptance. And he says, I never met the guy. It's like, that's it? You were with him for 3 years, and you denied him that quick? It's really a power that exerts itself, that we want to be part of a group. We do not want to be kicked out of a family group, a cultural group, any type of group. But after the resurrection, Peter's filled with the Holy Spirit, and they say, we gave you strict orders not to teach in his name, the Sanhedrin. And Peter said, we must obey God rather than the men. Suddenly, Peter doesn't care about being kicked out of a group. What happened to him? Right? He's filled with the Holy Spirit. And so when everybody's kneeling in protest to the flag, this Giants pitcher, James Coonrod, was the only one not to kneel. Afterwards, they asked him why. He says, I'm a Christian, so I just believe that I can't kneel before anybody besides God. It's only when you have a relationship with God can you not care about group pressure. Yeah. Jonathan Isaac, I met him. He's the only player not to kneel in protest of the flag. And afterwards, they asked him why. He goes, all lives are supported through the gospel. Everyone's made in the image of God, and we all share in his glory. And so this idea of, do we want the approval of man or the approval of God? All of humanity, why did God make us? Well, for a relationship. And so there has to be the choice not to have the relationship for the choice to be a choice to choose him. Right? For the forsaking of all others and choosing the one. And I'm skipping past stuff because of time. So, movies. Romance movies builds up to this moment of forsaking of all others and choosing the one. I think God is pushing the world to a decision-making moment. And what's the choice? Do you want to be accepted by the group? Do you want to be accepted by God? He set up this thing. And so the group gives you this group acceptance. But what's the state? The state is a weaponized group saying, if you don't cave to the government, then you're going to have all this bad stuff happen to you. And so God is putting us into a position where we have to make a choice. Do we want to be accepted by the group? If you want to be accepted by the group, the goalposts are constantly moving and they're going to take you like, you know, the J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter author, and you know, for the longest time, she was like, you know, oh, she's pushing stuff that's maybe not as biblical. Well, she stood up for man and woman. Well, guess what? The left dumped her, right? It's moving goalposts, and it's going to take them all the way to hell, and all the way to say, well, you got to accept Satan, and if the group says so. And then there's those that says, I'm sorry, this far and no further. I'm going to say no to the group, and I may lose my friends. I may have people block me. All I care about is Jesus. Amen. Anyway, thank you so much. Yeah.